The FDA's 510K pre-market notification process is the most common pathway new medical devices take to market in the United States. And while most 510K submissions are eventually cleared, almost 75% of first-time applications are initially rejected. So it's no wonder that 2014 510K reviews are taking an average of 114 days, and that's actually an improvement over years past. Staying current on 510K guidance is critical to making the process go as smoothly as possible for medical device manufacturers, and the FDA has issued quite a few related guidance documents on the topic in recent months. Here to speak with us about 510K submission strategies and how two recently issued guidances should influence your approach is Michael Drews, PhD, author of the Med Device Online guest column series, Guerrilla Regulatory Strategy. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. So based on your experience, what are the most important components of a successful 510K submission?
So that's a great question, Jim. Clearly, the two most important components of a successful 510K submission are the substantial equivalence argument and the risk mitigation strategy. Bottom line, as I like to describe it, you can fill out all of the forms, you can dot all of your I's, you can cross all of your T's, but if you don't have a very strong substantial equivalence argument, which is obviously the topic of this podcast today, and if you don't also have a bulletproof risk mitigation strategy, you probably are not going to be successful in getting your submission cleared, certainly getting cleared first time out of the box. As you mentioned in the introduction, the vast majority of 510K submissions today are rejected first time out of the box, and these are some of the reasons as to why. And by the way, one other thing I thought I would interject real quickly is that sometimes people ask me, is it possible for a 510K to be uncleared? And the short answer is yes, absolutely. That's what we call a rescission letter. It does not happen a lot. It's happened a total of about 100 times or 3 times per year on average. But once again, that's something that we would like to obviously avoid if we can.
Indeed. So you mentioned it. We don't have time to cover both of those components of a successful 510K submission during this podcast, but so let's focus in on substantial equivalence. What does that term mean, and how do you demonstrate substantial equivalence to FDA?
So substantial equivalence, as most of your audience knows, is the crux, really, of the medical device industry because we all rely on it so heavily to bring our products onto the market under the 510K, but how many of us really understand what it means? So before getting into the regulatory gobbledygook, I like to use metaphors that everybody can relate to. So here is one. Is a car substantially equivalent to a truck? Well, if we want to make that argument that a car is substantially equivalent to a truck, the strategy, the regulatory logic is quite simple. We want to emphasize the similarities, and at the same time, we want to de-emphasize or at least not draw attention to the differences. So once again, using that car-truck metaphor, if we wanted to bring a new truck onto the market using a car as its predicate, we would emphasize that both are vehicles for transportation, both have wheels, both have internal combustion engines, both consume fuel, both travel on roads, and so on and so on. At the same time, we have to acknowledge the differences. Cars usually have 4 wheels. Trucks might have as many as 18 wheels. Cars usually burn gasoline or perhaps electricity. Trucks oftentimes burn diesel fuel. Cars are usually designed to carry people and maybe a small amount of cargo. Trucks, on the other hand, much more cargo. So the substantial equivalence logic or the argument is we want to emphasize the similarities, and at the same time we want to de-emphasize or at least not draw attention to the differences. I'll use one other very simple metaphor that everybody can relate to, apples and oranges. Is an apple substantially equivalent to an orange? Well, once again, we want to emphasize the similarities. They're both fruits. They both grow on trees. They both deliver calories and nutrients and so on and so on. They both have skins. They both have seeds. But we also want to de-emphasize or not draw attention to the differences. They're different fruits. They're different colors. They have different nutritional content. They grow on different trees, and so on and so on. By the way, the reason why I like to use metaphors like that is because everybody understands what a car and a truck is. Everybody understands what an apple and an orange is. I do not have to spend 20 minutes explaining what a car or a truck is and how they're used. But let's remember that Einstein, very smart guy, Einstein said, if you can't explain something simply, you don't understand it well enough. So how can we have an intelligent conversation about showing substantial equivalence of a more complicated medical device like a vena cava filter or a hip implant without spending 20 or 30 minutes talking about, in the case of the vena cava filter, for example, deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary emboli and so on and so on. So yes, there is a method to my madness when I use simple metaphors like this.
I appreciate, and I'm sure the listeners do too, your taking pains to do that. And it sounds like it's a pretty fine line that that device makers need to walk in establishing substantial equivalence. Related to that, I guess it wasn't too long ago, maybe towards the end of July, FDA issued some new draft guidance related to substantial equivalences, specifically on benefit risk factors to consider when determining substantial equivalence in pre-market notifications. What do manufacturers need to understand about this new guidance, Mike?
So again, Jim, that's a great question. There have been several guidances that have come out in this general area in the last few months, because although the concept of the 510K and substantial equivalence has been around, in fact, since 1976, when the original Safe Medical Devices Act kicked in, it's still, although it's commonly used, it is very poorly understood, in my opinion. And this guidance tries to take us in a step in the direction of better understanding it. But actually, this particular guidance, I don't find very much new in it compared to what some of the other folks have been talking about. Because basically what CDRH is emphasizing, and this is right out of the original Code of Federal Regulations, is in order for a device to be shown substantially equivalent to its predicate, it has to have the same intended use as the predicate and the same technological characteristics, or it has to have the same intended use and different technological characteristics. So what does that mean? I have no idea. I don't think anybody really understands completely what it means, and yet I use this all the time. Same intended use means as long as you get to where you want to go, the different technological characteristics or the same technological characteristics, it doesn't matter. So once again, let me use a very simple metaphor that everybody can relate to. I can drive a car from Boston to Los Angeles. It would take me a couple of days to do it, but I could certainly do it. I could also fly an airplane to Boston, from Boston to Los Angeles. It would be a shorter time. It would be more efficient. Therefore, at the end of the day, I end up, either way I go, and in Los Angeles. So in other words, the same intended use, but I have different ways of getting there. That's exactly why. That's exactly the regulatory logic of the substantial equivalence argument in the 510K. And as you alluded to in your last comment, Jim, in terms of where exactly you draw that line, that is a very fuzzy thing, because if you wanted to extend that logic from beyond simply cars and airplanes, you could fly a helicopter from Boston to Los Angeles. You could ride your bicycle from Boston to Los Angeles. It might take a while, but you could do it. You could take a cruise ship from Boston to Los Angeles down through the Panama Canal. Indeed, you could even take a UFO from Boston to Los Angeles. At the end of the day, you get to Los Angeles, so the same intended use, the technology can be the same or different. And this, I hope, in the eyes of the audience, starts to understand why the 510K has become so debatable in the eyes of some folks. As a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, the Institute of Medicine came out with their recommendations on the 510K that it should be totally thrown away. In my opinion, I strongly disagree. I think that would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think the 510K, and more specifically the substantial equivalence regulatory logic, is a valid path to bring medical devices onto the market. But like any tool, it can be misused, and we'll get into that a little bit further as we get into the more of the discussion here.
So I guess moving on to another draft guidance that was issued recently, and this one's gotten quite a bit of attention, and again related to substantial equivalence. This one seeks to redefine a bit the idea of the notion of split predicates. So maybe I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what a split predicate is and what's the ramifications of this new guidance on split predicates for device manufacturers.
Well, it's a great topic, Jim, and you're right. There's been a lot of discussion in the last couple of months since this has come out. Not all of it for the better. But let me first go into exactly what we're talking about here. So what is the split predicate strategy? Well, once again, let me use a metaphor that everybody can relate to. So let's think of ketchup. If ketchup was new today, there was no other ketchup on the market, how could we get it onto the market under the 510K? Remember, there is no other ketchup out there. So one of the ways that we could do it is we could deconstruct the ketchup. In other words, what are the components that we find within the ketchup? We find tomatoes. Tomatoes are on the market. We find vinegar. Vinegar is also on the market. We find sugar. Sugar is on the market. We find a variety of spices. They're on the market. So basically, we add all of those different components up, and at the end of the day, what we end up with is ketchup. This is what we call the split predicate strategy. In the interest of full disclosure, I was one of the first to successfully argue the split predicate strategy at CDRH. I'm dating myself here about 20 years ago. At the time, I was using a multifunction patient monitor. This is within one monitor, within one box. We can measure blood pressure and respiratory rate and EKG and a variety of different things. Of course, today, this is ubiquitous. They're all over the place. But back in the day, 20-odd years ago, they did not exist. So what we did was we deconstructed that multifunction monitor, and we said there are already blood pressure monitors on the market, there are EKG monitors on the market, and so on and so on. We added those together, and therefore we were able to get this multifunction monitor onto the market using the split predicate strategy. Unfortunately, some folks have brought products onto the market using the split predicate strategy that perhaps in hindsight probably should not have been allowed to do, and as a result, they have caused problems, in some cases harm to patients, and so on and so on. Unfortunately, over the last couple of years, some folks at CDRH have been adamantly against the split predicate strategy, and in the companies that I've worked with up until recently, I've always advised them to consider the split predicate strategy and to use it if it made sense, but that they had to be aware, this is what I call regulatory risk, that some folks on the other side of the table, as soon as they see that this is the split predicate strategy, that will be a red flag, and you're opening yourself up to the possibility of getting questioned further on that. In my opinion, this is to ban the split predicate strategy does not make sense because the split predicate strategy is a tool, and like any other tool, like any other medical device, it can be used very effectively when it's used properly. When it's not used properly, of course, problems can develop. Now, one last thing I want to talk a little bit about is comparing the split predicate strategy to the multi-predicate strategy. These are similar phrases, but they're not quite the same. So when you think, hopefully this will help you and your audience keep this straight, when you think the split predicate strategy, think of the ketchup, as I said, you're deconstructing it into its individual components. When you think multi-predicate strategy, think about the legs of a stool. So a stool, the stability of the stool is a function of how many legs it has. In other words, if a stool only has one or two legs, it's going to be unstable. If you have three or four or five or seven legs, then that's the stability of the overall stool becomes greater and greater. So each of those legs under the stool can be thought of as different predicates. And you can bring, and I've done this successfully many times, you can bring medical devices onto the market under the 510K using the multi-predicate strategy where you identify not necessarily one predicate, but multiple predicates, multiple legs under that stool. But to take that stool metaphor even one step further, it's not simply the number of legs under the stool that's important. It's the relative strength or the relative length of each one. So in other words, you might have, say, 7 legs under your stool, but if one of those legs is much longer or much shorter than all of the rest, once again, the stability of the entire stool becomes compromised. So bottom line, both the split predicate strategy as well as the multi-predicate strategy can be, to use the regulatory metaphor, safe and effective regulatory tools when used properly. But when they're not used properly, then you can run into problems, just like any other medical device or drug for that matter. And I find it interesting now that in this recent guidance that you alluded to, FDA is trying to ban the split predicate strategy. Well, let's think about this for a second. As most of you in your audience knows, a guidance document is non-binding. So how can you tell people not to do something within a document that is not binding? I find in all of the debate that's going on around the split predicate strategy, and all of it is important debate, I have not seen many people talking about, gee, is this even possible to do within the context of the of a guidance document? If it were to ever go into the Code of Federal Regulations or in the Federal Register, that's a different thing. I hope, this is just my personal opinion, I hope that that does not happen, because I think that will really hamstring the industry and really prevent us from bringing a lot of important products onto the market. So bottom line, it's the balance. I understand FDA has a very important job to do. As I've said publicly many times, a physician can kill patients one at a time, but an FDA reviewer can kill patients thousands at a time. So we can't lose track of the importance that of the job of the FDA here. But on the other hand, we also have to be aware that the more regulatory hoops that we create, the more difficult it is for companies to bring products onto the market, and therefore how many people are going to be harmed or perhaps even killed because they don't have access to a particular medical device because a company decided, you know what, the regulatory burden is too great, it's just not worth it for us to do, and therefore how many people get harmed because they don't have access to one of these devices. It's a fine line. There is definitely a balance. There is a fulcrum. There is a pivot point in there somewhere. I have no idea where it is. This is a topic that is very important to us as an industry and indeed to all of us as a society, and we need more people talking about such things.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's a fascinating time that we're in right now, an environment, regulatory environment related to medical devices. So I guess to wrap things up, Mike, what do manufacturers need to think about moving forward as it relates to the 510K pathway?
Well, there's a lot of things that are changing, but then again, this industry has been changing since 1976 when, as I alluded to earlier, the Safe Medical Devices Act originally kicked in. Bottom line, I would like to leave your audience with something that Stephen Covey, who wrote 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, said, begin with the end in mind. So if you have a medical device that you hope to bring to market under the 510K, before you start writing your submission, before you even start doing any of your testing or very early on even in your design process, begin with the end in mind. Figure out what it is exactly that you want to accomplish here. And one of the best places to start is with the label claims, with the intended use. So apply a little Stephen Coveyism, begin with the end in mind from the very beginning, and I have lots of examples that we can go into in a different interview with that. And begin with the end in mind, and it will be a very effective strategy in the vast majority of times. I use it frequently myself. And one last final comment, when you think about writing regulatory submissions, there are a lot of folks out there that write regulatory submissions, 510Ks and PMAs and so on and so on. I don't. I never have. instead of writing a submission, I design a submission. Just like an engineer would sit down and design a widget of some kind, I design a regulatory submission. And the regulation is useful in telling me what kinds of general information that I need to put in there. But I think what is even more important than what the regulation says is what the regulation does not say. So bottom line, there are a lot of ways to communicate your message beyond just the words that you use. So think about, begin with the end in mind, and also think about designing a submission as opposed to simply writing one. And if you employ those two techniques, I think that will take you a long way to not being in the majority of 75% of 510Ks that are rejected first time out of the box, and instead put you in the minority, where I am, of the 20 or 25% of 510K and PMA submissions that are accepted first time out of the box. That would be a great place to start.
Yeah, indeed. Well, two really great pieces of advice to close with there, Mike. We really appreciate you taking some time today to talk to us about the 510K pathway and some of these recent guidances by FDA. And thanks for sharing your wisdom with us again.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's always a pleasure to be here. And I'd just like to remind your audience that I have a webinar coming up soon, specifically on the 510K, where I will go into all of the examples and more in much more detail. I will also use actual medical device case studies to illustrate a lot of these points. And more specifically, if anybody has any questions on how to implement any of these strategies in their own organization, I would be more than happy to chat with you.
Yeah, that podcast or that webinar that Mike just mentioned is taking place on October 16th, 2014, at 1 p.m. And I'll post a link to the course description and the registration information in the podcast notes. And you can also visit www.lifesciencetraininginstitute.com for more information on that. In addition, I'll also include Mike's contact information as well as links to some of the guidance documents that he referenced in today's podcast. So, Mike, thanks again. And listeners, I appreciate your time, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.